Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode, we can give this one a number, 229, buddy.
We can. It's a special episode.
For a lot of reasons.
Yes.
For very many reasons.
Name four.
It's a quiz? Yeah. Okay. It's a themed episode. We're going to talk about Robin Williams movies.
Okay.
We're going to celebrate his career. It's with an intern who we've never had on the show.
Okay, great. Two.
It's, we have a Kickstarter backer ad.
Three.
Okay. And this episode is dropping while I am in China.
All right. Done.
Suck four. It,
baby. Yeah, nice.
Didn't know I was going to be challenged out of the gate.
Got to keep you on your toes.
I know. Holy shit.
This is really exciting. And one of the things, too, when I have Aaron on, let's introduce him.
Couldn't hurt.
Yeah. This is one of the interns, also one of the interns for ATC, for mm-hmm. All Things Comedy, and also a big comedy fan, can tell you pretty much anything you want to know about a lot of comedians working today, and all ones, you know, in the past, too. He's just a comedy fan, and that's also one of the reasons why we wanted to have him on this show today, to have a fan's perspective.
Perspective, which mm-hmm. we've done a couple, one or two of these intern shows. We've had Ben on, we've had Keith.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? We anyone else?
Ben, Keith. No, I think that's it.
We never had Sharon on when she was...
No.
I don't even think we had the podcast when she was...
No, Sharon was our first intern, just worked on the website.
Right. Yeah. Before we had anything else.
Mm-hmm. Poor bastard.
I know. Mm-hmm. And Dan, we had Dan on, right? Remember when he was...
Oh, well, yeah. Dan would... he would chime in, too.
Same with Sean.
Okay, yeah. So if you're playing along at home, I'm the last one to come on the show. Yeah.
No, there's a few more.
You guys
more.
Went to Japan and interviewed Sanai before me. I live a mile and a half away.
Yeah, well, you need to live in a more exotic location.
That's true.
So here he is, Aaron Brunghart. Did I say it right?
Brunghart.
Okay.
Really exercise the G.
Brunghart.
Yeah.
Now, Technically not true because we interviewed you for the film.
That's true.
Before Sinai.
That's right. You came by mm-hmm. to the improv. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's when Aaron said something very surprising to me. He said it would be a dream to be on the Comedy Film Nerds podcast.
We had no idea. Most people are scared.
Yeah,
to be on it.
I don't know.
And
what's up with them?
What's yeah.
I've got a sword. I can hack it here. Look, let's go.
So, when did you first start listening to the show? What turned you on to Comedy Film Nerds?
I think early on, you know, I was into WTF was probably the gateway, and oddly enough, the Robin Williams episode was the one I was told you have to listen to this.
Uh-huh.
And then I went back and devoured the catalog to that point,
right,
which was still all available. And then it was just like, okay, podcasts are great. I'm all cut up on WTF. What else can I find? And it was like, I just like typed in Doug Benson because I already knew Doug loves movies and he was, you know, one of your first mm-hmm. guests. So that's how I was led to be a comedy film nerd.
Cool.
That's how I got my kitten hands.
Nice. Now,
it was funny to know when he walked in that we're like, you'd never been in here. You went, no. And you went, wow, there's the weight bench.
Yeah, there's the gargoyles. There's the merch.
There's the actual kitten hands.
And you see Dean Haglund's painting of us.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah. There's our original microphone, the Snowball Blue
that's
behind you.
We first started recording the episode on. So now, Aaron, before we get started, when did you first start following and listening to comedians? Because this seems like it's is like a lifelong thing.
I would say it is. I mean, more so watching the specials. And I think for people my age, I'm 31, and I think it was around 2000 or 1999 when so many of your peers started having their specials, their half hours mm-hmm. or hours on Comedy Central and just constantly on repeat. So, you know, I was 16 or whatever at that time, just at home watching TV. So, I mean, it's hard to avoid it at a certain point, especially when it's kind of the only thing on all day.
Right.
There's Incredible Hulk reruns. I'm well versed in Quantum Leap and comedy specials from 2000 on.
Nice.
Yeah. I even watched, Strip Poker. Graham Elwood hosted game show on USA.
I've helped shape so many young boys' lives on Strip Poker. It was great that I was able to participate in any of your whack-off fantasies, at least facilitate them. Hopefully I wasn't in them, but at least the...
And I, you know, facilitated the the maturing of middle-aged women when I was writing for Port Charles.
It's the Lord's work, what we do here in show business town. Yeah, well, I'm glad you enjoyed strip poker. Any favorite strip poker episodes that stand out?
I think the one with girls in it.
Oh, right, yeah, right. One. Where they got in bikinis. Uh-huh. And, yeah, yeah, I made fun of them and the boys. Right, mm-hmm. It's good stuff. Yeah, it was 195.
Loud shirt.
Loud.
Picked up by a stylist.
Yes, I had a bowling shirt with fire on it, or dice, or dice and fire, or a martini glass with fire and dice.
Well, that was the promo picture.
It was. That's what we had. You know what I think I should include? I should bring over here. I think I still have some strip poker promo photos.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Color ones. Oh, I'm going to bring those over. Yeah. I might even have a cram one, too, but I'll bring over the strip poker ones. Because those
bring
them
to the festival.
That's a fan giveaway.
Oh, yeah. I'll bring those to the festival. Come to the Comedy Film Nerds Live at the PodFest.
That's a good giveaway.
That's a great giveaway. I forgot I had that shit. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome.
For reminding me.
Thank you.
Reminded me of the glories of cable television.
So, well, let's talk about our ad, our Kickstarter
this
backer.
This is a very special one.
This is really special. This is, you know, it's not only a promotion, but a message.
It's a message, very, very important message. And usually it's like someone's personal business that they want to promote on Kickstarter. This one's a little different.
It's very passionate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is Brian Shanovich, and what do you want the ad to say? And this is what he typed in. Eat healthy foods. Now, that's great advice.
Right, good advice. Right? I think that's a good ad.
Yeah. Buy from your local farmers markets. Again, great advice.
I love that. Support local farmers. Yes. Like we talk about that in this show. Mm-hmm. Vote with your dollars. Yeah. Support your local farmer.
And screw Whole Foods. That's what he typed. He typed those three sentences.
That was worth $350.
Yes. God bless you.
Thank you for supporting Brian. Earbuds, the podcasting documentary, and going on a diatribe event to Whole Foods.
Yes. You know, take it to those corporate bitches. Yes. One podcast at a time. Right. Take them down.
This is the way to do it. So anybody has a manifesto, send it to us and we'll read it.
It only costs you $350.
$350 to read your manifesto.
How else are you going
to
get your manifesto on the air? I mean,
imagine
seriously.
If the Unabomber had podcasting back in the day.
CNN charges more.
I know. Yeah.
You know, we're cheaper.
And they're dicks.
Yeah.
You got to have a gun.
I know. That's what this show's all about. It's kind of hard to transition off of that. I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah, a little bit.
Should we just wrap up the episode?
Yeah, just like, all right, see you next week, everybody.
I did it, guys.
Thank you.
Finally.
Congratulations, Aaron. This is your dream come true, buddy.
And this is what Robin Williams would have wanted.
Yeah, just fucking up a show and bailing. Yeah.
So let's talk about this. Obviously, this has been unbelievably tragic for everyone, even more so in the comedy community, because I will say this, too. You know, comedians have passed away before, comedians that I've known personally. And I've never met Robin Williams, but a lot of comedians on Facebook that I'm friends with have pictures of them with him. And I've never seen so many pictures with any other single celebrity or famous comedian before that everyone had, which is a testament to Robin Williams on how accessible and how much he loved just stand-up comedy. No matter how famous or big he got, it was still a love of his.
I think, you know, and part of that comes from, you know, that the Throckmorton Theater, I believe, in Mill Valley, that gig that Mark Pitta books. And I did it once. You know, I worked with him somewhere, Vegas or something like that. And he's like, yeah, come do this. And it's like a Tuesday night.
Right.
It's this awesome theater in this really cool town. And, you know, in the green room is Mort Saul and Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Wow, just hanging out because they like, you know, they like talking about comedy and you know.
And they were huge fans of strip poker.
They love strip poker. They both had Loud bowling shirts and leopard skin shoes, which I had on that show. And, you know, it was really, I was like, wow, there's Robin Williams. And, you know, I believe it was the Marc Maron episode where he talked about, because, you know, he had a reputation of taking material. Yeah. And a lot of comics were like,
they didn't want to perform with him
to perform with him around. And he said that theater was where he felt sort of safe. And I think, too, as some time had passed, I think comics were a little more open to, like, having him around. And then his body of work as an actor, that's what, you know,
it became greater and greater.
It became greater and greater. And I think that was one of the things, at least for me, and, you know, we talked about it a little bit when he first passed away a couple weeks ago. There's no other comic that transcended from club act to actor. Some of them have gotten famous, maybe as much fame as he've had, like Billy Crystal or whatever. But Billy Crystal is not known as this amazing actor that can play all these. Even Whoopi Goldberg, his two contemporaries, you know, they both, Whoopi and Billy, have, you know, done some good movies, some not or whatever. But
Whoopi's got an Oscar.
Yeah, Whoopi's got an Oscar, and they're, but Robin Williams, and we're going to go through that today. All of the different parts that he played, and how he was an actor. He wasn't a comedian that became a film star.
Right.
He was an actor, and I think that's to me at least was because I would, you know, when I remember when I first moved to LA and had been a comic for a while and started taking acting classes at Playhouse West and you know, it was there wasn't a lot of stand-up comics taking serious acting classes, but he was the guy that was always referenced.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're trying to be like a Robin Williams or have Robin Williams' career or whatever.
It's the best ever.
It's his career is goddamn amazing. If you think about it, what he accomplished, because he didn't just like jump over from a sitcom and then play Mork for 15 years.
Right.
You know, and just keep, like, we've talked about there's numerous comedic actors we've talked about on the show that we get frustrated when they just do the same thing over and over. I mean, he definitely had those movies that weren't good, like Club Paradise, where clearly it was just like, just let Robin go. Yeah. You know, just
there was
turn the camera on.
He had that Tom Hanks phase where just kind of took anything.
Sure.
Yeah, and you see also there's a lot of cameos.
Well, I think the 80s just had, I mean, Club Paradise and Summer Rental and just all
don't
those
forget
movies
Toys.
That people had. Toys was awful. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And but you look at him
young
too.
Robin Wright Penn.
Yeah.
Robin Wright at the time.
I remember as a kid watching Robin Williams in Happy Days. And you know, people don't even realize sometimes that Mork and Mindy was a spinoff from Happy Days. That's where he actually started. And originally I remember the episode that he was in. No one was thinking spinoff at the time. And then when they reran that episode, they added a tag at the end. And it was him talking back to the mothership where it was Orson saying, I don't want to go to, you know, Boulder. Why do I have to go to Boulder? Right. And then they had that tag to set up the spinoff that he was actually going to, which I thought was really cool. Even as a kid, I thought, oh, this is so cool. And I think
the episode title, by the way, was Fonzie Jumps an Alien on his motorcycle.
Yeah. Was that after the shark? Was the alien, was Mork after the shark or was it before? I can't remember. The Happy Days order. But I want to make a comparison too with Robin Williams, just his film career. It's really similar to what Johnny Depp did in the early days, because you look at the roles that he played. It was a lot of outcasts and characters that were like on the fringe of society for one reason or another. And that's a lot of the things what Johnny Depp did, but in a more extreme way. So you look at this kind of build of a career, and it's absolutely fascinating. He always seemed comfortable in those roles. Everything from like the genie to like the Fisher King to Good Will Hunting. There was always something like that didn't fit in about that character. Some haunted past, something that, and it was always fascinating to watch.
I think that's, I mean, I think most comedians feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I agree. Yeah.
You feel that's why you gravitate.
I'm never really going to fit in anywhere.
I'm never going to fit in anywhere. I'm always sort of the, because even when you are on stage, you're the outcast.
Yeah, you're the one.
You're the one guy in the room doing this. Now, sure, it's if the show's going well, people like you, whatever. Even if you have fans and they buy tickets, it's still, they're still coming to watch the freak.
Right.
You know, like anybody. And oh, he's so brave and he talks about all this personal stuff. It's like, oh, Jesus. Like that's success is, you know, look at my madness or my insanity or my insecurities or my fears or whatever. And he translated that in a lot. So let's kind of go. I didn't realize this till I'm looking at IMDb right now and sort of timeline. I always thought World According to Garp was the first one that popped out. It was wrong. Popeye.
Yeah, Popeye's the
first. Yes, Popeye was the big one.
Came out in 1980. And I remember as a kid, and I watch it just because, oh, Mork is doing
Popeye.
Bang, doing Popeye. And Robert Altman directed it. We were corrected on. Yes. We said John Huston. We got it corrected immediately. Yeah. And it was one of those films where, you know, I don't.
First of all, it was a musical.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's.
It had a $20 million budget, which back then, that was a lot of money.
And 15 of that went to cocaine.
Yeah. That was back in the coke years.
And you also, I just watched this movie again recently.
I watched it yesterday.
And really? Like literally.
I was gearing up.
Yeah, I watched it a couple days ago too with the kids because they had never seen it. And you realize that Robin Williams is pretty much a character come, like a cartoon come to life. Like he plays Popeye. The way if a cartoon character was real, that's what it would be. It's not right. Just the giant forearms. It's the way he moved, the way he talked, and everything. He just kind of lost himself in this, you know, weird cartoony role. And now, you know, my kids have never seen the Popeye cartoons. It's they liked the movie. But when you're watching this movie, it's not a great movie, by the way.
No.
It is not. You can't watch this movie. Oh, this is hard. A classic. No, it's it's tough to get through. But in a weird way, it's also you can't stop watching it because of, you know, even Shelley Duvall playing Olive Oil, like, oh my God, she's actually good in a role. You know, this almost makes you forget about her almost ruining The Shining.
Yeah.
She's actually well cast here.
Oh, you didn't like The Shining? You didn't like her in The Shining?
Oh my God, she almost ruined that movie. She's awful in The Shining.
Well, to be fair, Stanley Kubrick was slapping her between takes. So
yeah.
It'd be pretty hard to act.
Yeah. It'd be hard to do that if Stanley Kubrick was abusing me.
You know, I'm sure that was happening to, you know, what was
the kid?
Scatman Crothers.
Yes, so. Yeah, slapping Scatman Crothers.
So,
Hong Kong Fooey. Stop it.
So, you know, he pulled it off. So, so was that true that he was actually?
I believe in some shots. That's what happened.
No way! Yeah. Wow. See, I thought you were kidding.
No.
That's
why I'm saying you got to cut her some slack because she was.
Well, yeah, I didn't realize there was physical abuse on the set
by a lunatic.
Yeah,
who wants 100 takes of every shot?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Didn't Robert Duvall kind of stomp on the set and take care of things?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope that's what happened. I hope he knocked.
Jesus
comes in, threatens him about it with a horse head or something.
Yeah. Yeah, come on.
Kraut Mick friend. All right, so let's then the breakout role for him then was World According to Garp.
Yeah.
Which is still one of those movies. I mean, it's based on a novel. It came out in 1982. It was directed by George Roy Hill. John Irving wrote the novel. And it was one of those movies where I watched that movie as a kid and it struck me. Again, he's this quirky dude who's on the outside, you know what I mean? The way he was conceived was weird. And
well, that book is absolutely insane too.
Right.
If you ever read the entire, if you read any John Irving novel,
right,
you realize that, oh, okay, this is written by someone whose brain process thinks completely differently than anyone else. So I think this is one of the first movies too that showed. I mean, Popeye, he was playing a cartoon character.
Sure,
yeah.
You know, you see the potential of acting in a certain genre. Like, okay, he's going to be great in comedy movies. He's a physical actor. Right. Blah blah blah.
He's able to keep one eye closed for two hours.
You don't see any of that potential that would lead you to think, oh, he's going to be great in Garp.
Yeah.
You don't see it there.
Mm-hmm.
And when Garp came on the scene, when it was released, you realize, oh my God, there's so much more to him than just kind of, you know, this manic comedian that could lose himself in a cartoon role. This is an actual role. And it also required not just drama, but comedy at the same time. Another good example of that is Good Morning Vietnam. When you look at Good Morning Vietnam, it's like not only do you need the strong comedy skills, especially when he's on the radio, but then also the drama when he's not on the radio.
In the war zone.
In the war zone.
Well, let me ask you this, Aaron. So since you weren't you know, like watching these movies when they came out, when did you get turned on to them, and how, and what was your, what age and what was your reaction when you started, when you first, like what was the first Robin Williams movie you saw? Let's start there.
I would think it was Popeye.
Oh, really?
Because I watched a ton of cartoons, and so I knew, I knew of it, and I knew of him. I probably didn't see it till closer to 1990 or something like that.
Right.
Because I wasn't even alive when it was out. But, you know, I think that was the first one. And obviously the crossover, because it, it is a cartoon. Because I certainly wasn't looking up for Robert Altman movies going, which one am I going to check out next?
Right, right. So then when you saw Garp.
The Player or Popeye?
When you saw The Whirling According to Garp, how old were you and what was your reaction to it?
That's one I still haven't seen.
Really?
Yeah. For a long time in my life, I had a hard time getting that straight with what's eating Gilbert Grape, because they're long. They start with W, Grape, Garp. I don't know. It just, I lost it somewhere in the...
What's eating Gilbert Garp?
Yeah. I just never got a hold of that one.
Well, here's what I recommend. Read the novel first, then watch the film, and that'll take you about 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, the movie, again, it was one of these films I saw when I was a kid, probably one of the movies I should...
No, I did not see it as a kid. Yeah. I don't think I was allowed to see it as a kid.
Oh, my parents took me to a bunch of stuff I shouldn't have been watching. And I was like completely blown away by it because... there's so many heavy moments in that movie.
What year was that?
And that was 1982. There were so many heavy moments in that movie, and then hilarious moments. And as a kid, I was so mesmerized by the fact, well, there's funny Garp, or there's funny Mork, you know.
So you were 13?
Yeah. And I was like...
I can imagine not everything resonated with you in that film. It was so weird.
Some did, though.
Yeah.
You know, I was learning about sex and violence way too young. So
it inappropriately resonated with you.
Yeah, and the worst time at the wrong moment.
Yeah.
You're just entering into adolescence. Learning about all this weird sexual shit and all the stuff that happens in that film. So it's great. It doesn't make that time even more confusing at all.
No, not at all, because there's no discussions of deviant sexual behavior in that movie at all.
Not at all. There are any weird sex acts that happened in that movie. And then as you move, I think I had just moved from Madison, Wisconsin to Chicago. That wasn't difficult to deal with at all. So then this movie just ironed it all out. It really made that time brilliant. I think I got braces. It was awesome. Yeah. Gawky body, braces, acne. And then
you met John Lithgow and asked him why he wasn't in a dress.
Yeah. John Lithgow was a transsexual football player woman thing. So that was great. Yeah. This movie was awesome.
See, I saw movies like when I was three. I saw, and I distinctly remember seeing Friday the 13th Part 3 or 4, something like that.
Great for a three-year-old.
Great.
Perfect.
Jaws, great.
Also so inappropriate.
Like, yeah. So I'm like afraid of the water and the woods
at the same time.
So luckily,
you should be.
Luckily, I lived in cities, so it wasn't.
Mm. Did you see Candyman?
No, I still haven't seen Candyman.
So then,
it's on my list.
It would give you nowhere to live after if you saw that at three.
So then you had, well, like The Survivors, which, you know, is a weird Walter Matthau movie. It was one of those films where just like, how did this?
Yeah, it was like,
that was like Tom Hanks's,
or
that was like when Tom Hanks was doing stuff like Neighbors.
Man with One Red Shoe.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks didn't do Neighbors. That was... you're thinking of John Belushi.
Oh, John Belushi, right.
Yeah. But that was the Tom Hanks and Man with One Red Shoe and all those like Volunteers and
Volunteers and Stripes. And
yeah, The Burbs.
That's the one.
Burbs.
Yeah, The Burbs.
So then you had, but then of course, again, another movie that I absolutely loved was Moscow on the Hudson.
Yeah, that movie's great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Which, you know, again, I was 14 or something at the time and got to see Maria Conchita Alonso's boobs in it. And that was wonderful.
What's wrong with sex? Sex is good for you.
Yeah. That was another movie that, you know, it's height of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So he defects.
Yeah, he's a circus performer.
He's a circus
musician.
He's a musician. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And and what it's like being, especially that's Manhattan in the 80s,
right?
Which was very sort of, you know, Snake Plissken up for grabs. and so that film, what did you think of that when you saw that, Aaron?
I mean, it's amazing. He learned to speak Russian for just the commitment as an actor. He learned to speak Russian and play the saxophone for that role. Like they're not dicking around dubbing it in later. Right. I mean, he did it all, you know, and he's not just doing improv gibberish,
right?
Russian, you know, he's and speaking the actual language.
Those aren't two easy things. Russian.
No. Yeah. No, saxophone. Yeah. They tried to teach me Russian at one point and it was like, what are these Legos? These are not letters. These are Legos.
Yeah. And that was with Paul Mazursky. God, look at the directors he's worked with. You know, like he's worked with some pretty amazing.
Yeah, and he said that the guy they hired to teach him Russian, he said this on his Inside the Actor's Studio, that the guy who taught him Russian was also an acting professor in Russia or something like that. So he said he credited him with really, you know, getting him right both in the language and in the role.
Right. And then, you know, he had this, The Best of Times and Club Paradise, Seize the Day. But then he did Good Morning Vietnam, which, as you were talking about, well, first of all, he did a TV movie. He did the voice on this, which is a really good TV movie documentary, Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, which is a great book that somebody collected letters from Vietnam soldiers that they had written home to their families and all of the things they're talking about.
God, I don't even remember this. This was a TV movie?
It was a documentary that I think was on. Yeah, it was a TV movie. They basically just hired actors to read
the letters.
To read the letters.
Yeah, kind of like Ken Burns did with the Civil War.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they hired people like William Dafoe and Tom Berenger and people who'd been in Vietnam films.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kevin Dillon and so...
Gary Busey.
Yeah. Is he in it? Maybe.
I think you mean Gary Sinise.
Yeah. Brian Dennehy's in it. The reason I bring this up is because I read that book and I read the actual letters and it's really powerful because... First of all, it's a different era in terms of there was no Skype or
right.
Yeah.
Soldiers couldn't call home or anything like that. They had to write letters in their tent or whatever and
under fire
or between
in the foxhole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like this awful thing happened today and there's pools of blood in the mud and they're sending that back to their brother or whatever. And so it's a book I should suggest reading or watch this documentary. But then you had Good Morning Vietnam, which is just, the more we talk about this, the more it's fascinating because, again, Good Morning Vietnam, I mean, they kind of build it as a comedy, zany, you know, Good Morning Vietnam, right? And
anything with the word Vietnam in the title, you should kind of know that this shouldn't be marketed as a comedy.
Right. Yeah. It's but the thing about Good Morning Vietnam that I thought was amazing, again, Barry Levinson, another, you know, big name director. It's young Forrest Whitaker's in it. And Bruno Kirby is great as just, he plays a great tool. you've got all these great, you've got Robert Wool in it, and then JT Walsh, who's just a complete asshole. And it's Richard Edson, who else is, there's all these.
Richard Edson was in Platoon.
Yeah, he was in both.
Yeah.
And
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, all the same year.
Yeah, I know. That was his character actor, you know, grand slam.
Yeah.
But Good Morning Vietnam was one of those things where everybody talked about how he just improvised the radio scenes. Barry Levinson just put a camera on him and said, be a morning DJ. And this actual guy that he was depicting when the movie came out was like, I didn't come close to
wish
any
I was
of
that
it,
good.
You know what I mean? And again, then it has these, so many of his movies kind of tricked you into, ha ha, Robin Williams. And then there's these heavy moments in that film because he's in a war zone, you know, and he befriends that kid.
Mm-hmm. Saves his life.
Saves mm-hmm. his life, and the way the kid talks about, you know, Robin's like, you know, we were supposed to be friends, and he's like, friends, what are you talking about? You GIs come in here and
you're the enemy.
Yeah, you blow everything up and you knock up these girls and then split, and I'm supposed to be your friend, you know? Which was good stuff.
Resonant. But is it not, I mean, do you not agree that it's the perfect kind of role for a stand-up? Like, you go up, you perform.
Well, for the right stand-up.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, yeah. Robin obviously is the perfect guy for it, but I'm just saying in terms of, like, you walk up to this weird place, you do your performance, then you walk out into the horror of the rest of the world, and maybe hopefully you've brightened a few days.
Oh, right. You're talking about being a DJ, like a radio DJ?
In a war zone like that, right. Yeah. I mean, well,
it was one of those things where that scene, you know, resonated with me later, obviously, when I started going overseas, where he's like, fuck this. I'm tired of the bureaucracy, and they're stuck, and Forrest Whitaker, and he's like, I'm quitting, and Forrest Whitaker looks around and goes, hey, guys, look who I've got with me. And he forces, you know, Robin Williams' character to perform basically for these guys. And he sees his value and the importance of it. And, I remember that scene, like, sort of popping into my memory as the first time I went over there and was like, what am I doing? Like, this is terrifying. This is stupid. I don't feel like, and numerous times on those trips, I remember when, I went over there once with Scott Kennedy, who passed away like a little over a year ago. And Scott Kennedy was a comic who we've mentioned on the show before. He went over there like 50 some times, and we were getting ready to fly to do. We're going to go to some base. We had three shows a day. Scott always had us going to like three or four shows a day on all small fire bases. And we're on the flight line, which is basically the landing deck for helicopters. And we're waiting for our ride, and it's early in the morning. And all of a sudden he gets a call and he said, this base we were supposed to go to got into a firefight last night and two guys died. So we're not going. The show's. And I remember sitting on there going, and I was sitting there going, God, I feel so stupid. I was like, I feel like, who cares? I was like, who cares what we're flying around telling jokes? I felt so dumb and useless. And like, you know, these guys on this base are going through something awful. The families just got the worst news. And, and I've been on aircraft where we picked up flag brave coffins. So I knew like what was going to happen next. And I said, this is kind of, I just feel like such a fucking asshole. And he goes, Graham, I'm coming here every month, 4 or 5 months from now, I will go back to these bases and make sure they get a show. He goes, I had a commanding officer tell me that every time a comedy show comes through town, suicide rate drops, comes through the base, the suicide rate on the base drops. He goes, so we're saving lives and we're going to find other shows to do today. And I was like, he just kind of knocked me back, set me straight. And I was just like, this is your job. This is your mission. Let's go.
And this is why it is important.
This is why useful. It's so important. And it's what I lived out that actual scene. That was what that scene in Good Morning Vietnam was. I had that actually happen to me. And so going back, it makes that movie for me at least more poignant.
On a lighter note, do you not get that with podcast fans too, where you're walking around kind of anonymously, then they hear your voice, you're talking to a barista or something, and then they go, Graham Elwood? I feel like I have that all the time around town.
Well, I don't get recognized that much but you know what, I do get it from coming up after shows or the emails we get.
Or in Japan.
Or like, well, you know, when we did all these interviews for the documentary for Earbuds, but one of the reasons why we wanted to do the documentary was we got the emails. And there's been plenty of days where Chris or myself were like, oh, this isn't making any money and what the fuck are we doing? And we get some email about, hey, your podcast helped me get through this. Yeah. And we go,
or it inspired me to do this.
Right. Right. Or yeah, tough time, parent passed away or something like that. And then you go, oh, and it does really bring that back. Cause especially this, even more so than stand up, we're literally just in a garage. Like, is anyone listening to this? You know? And you forget that when you put it out there on the internet, thousands of people do hear it. So that is a weird thing. So, and then we've got, then after that, he does some other, what does Adventures of Baron Munchausen?
Now, he wasn't a lead in that. Adventures of Baron Munchausen. He was the man in the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great cameo. The thing that I loved about it too is it kind of set up his relationship with Terry Gilliam for when they did The Fisher King together.
Yeah. Which, jumping forward, again, great movie. Yeah, funny Robin Williams, but this
dark,
super heavy,
social commentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, how he became homeless?
Yeah.
At a restaurant, and his wife got gunned down, like, and he lost his shit.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's pretty heavy stuff. The other thing I love it about the collaboration is Terry Gilliam and Robin Williams have a lot in common. In that they put on the surface goofy, funny characters, but underneath there is a lot of dark shit going on. Like even if you look at a movie like Brazil, where there's a lot of laugh out loud funny moments, but underneath it's terrifyingly morbid and dark.
Here's your fucked up future.
Yeah. Like, yeah, isn't it hilarious?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, wait, no, this is terrifying, mm-hmm. and it might actually happen.
And here with comic relief, Robert De Niro.
Yeah, yeah. When Robert De Niro is playing comic relief in a movie, you know that movie's dark.
That's what he's known for, guys.
Yeah. So you look at when
Cape
they
Fear.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
When they get together, you see that Robin Williams and Terry Gilliam had such a kindred spirit. You could see on the collaboration just how much they were so in sync. And I honestly, it's not one of his more well-known movies, but Fisher King is probably one of my favorites.
It's great. Yeah, I just watched it this morning.
What did you think of it watching it again? Because it came out in 1991.
I feel like I saw it probably too young. I was probably like 11. And I vividly remember seeing the scenes of his wife dying and his breakdown as in relation to that. And I mean, it was just as heavy as I remember, or more, you know, now that I'm the age where that sort of crazy thing could happen, you know?
Right.
I mean,
especially when you think about two of them, you had two good, and Jeff Bridges' character loses his shit, you know, he's a shock jock. And then
he kind of causes the mass shooting.
Or has a hand in it, at least, you know? I mean, he kind of incites these.
He kind of eggs on the guy who does it.
You know? Right. And then when he meets Robin Williams and how he sort of has his transformation, but then you also sort of see who he really is, you know? And it is sort of, Fisher King has some heavy indictments about corporate media and corporate America, you know, and the
tied in with the themes of religion too.
And how willingness we are to sell out, you know, Jeff Bridges is so willing to just sell out, you know, and, but I want to get back to, between, Fisher King. Well, there was Dead Poets Society came out in 1989, and then we had Cadillac Man, Awakenings, which is interesting. Dead Again, Shakes the Clown. But
I think that was what was interesting when I looked back at IMDb was at his career was he almost went comedy, drama. I mean, as early as Garp.
Yeah, you almost feel like he's doing that classic one for them, one for me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I get to do Dead Poets Society. Okay, I'll make Cadillac Man.
Dead Again is one movie that, again, it's just a cameo.
Yeah.
And it's, again, not a great movie, but his cameo is so interesting. Really just, it's that kind of thing. Well, wait, I kind of want to see more of this character, but you never do. It's just a short, it's a kind of thing with Kenneth Branagh threw in.
But I want to get back to Dead Poets Society, because then that was another.
This is another huge one for his career.
Because it was a huge one.
And everyone I knew saw that movie. It was one of those movies that literally everyone talked about, everyone saw, and it was not, oh, you didn't see Deadpool? Was it like, then there's something wrong with you if you hadn't gone to see that movie?
Well, because I think it, you know, I was just getting out of high school and going into college, and, you know, I went to public school. I didn't go to like rich kid prep schools, but still there was that pressure of, got to get good grades, got to go to a good college. If you don't go to a good college, you're screwed.
That would have been great if that was actually the name of the school. Wait. Rich Kid Prep School.
Rich Kid Prep School. but I remember...
Oh, I didn't get into Rich Kid Prep School. Yeah. All right. Got to go to middle class. Middle class university.
Yeah. Their mascot is the Whining Crowns.
Yeah.
The trust funders.
Yeah.
So, but I remember though why that movie resonated with me was Evanston, the suburb I grew up in, is on the North Shore of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Which, just watch a John Hughes movie and that'll give you an idea of what it was like.
Yeah.
But there was all these
Loyola's right there.
Loyola, right? You've got Loyola University. You've also got Loyola Academy. But you've got Evanston, Wilmette, Winnetka, Glencoe. Evanston is integrated. It's been integrated for like over 100 years, but the rest of them are very white and very wealthy. And I remember like dating a girl that went to a private Catholic school and going to one of her winter formals and all these rich kids and everything. But then I remember that they did have that they had a dad and a mom who were like, you're going to this school. Like, I remember a girl told me, she wasn't allowed to apply to colleges west of the Mississippi because her parents were like, there's no good schools out there. And they were like, a lot of them were like, you're not going to school in California because you're going to go lose your shit out there.
Yeah.
Like, you had to go to an Ivy League school. And if you didn't...
No one's going to college and coming out hippie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're not going to think for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing a lot of kids like that. And so when this movie came out, I was like... It made total sense, and it also launched all these, you know, Robert Sean Leonard, Ethan Hawke, Josh Charles, like all these.
That was a huge cast. Yeah.
It
was
huge.
And, it's like Diner.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, they were all really young. And then Norman Lloyd is in it, who I remember from St. Elsewhere. And it's one of those movies that the message is in it. I'll never forget that when he did that scene where he's like, look at all these guys before. And he goes, they're all dead. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, better go seize the day. It was directed by Peter Weir, who has also directed, he directed.
Did 2010.
Yeah, he did Truman. He did The Way Back. He did a bunch of interesting stuff.
Yeah, The Mosquito Coast. Did he do that with Harrison Ford?
Yeah. Let's check here. Peter Weir did Mosquito Coast. Year of Living Dangerously, Mosquito Coast, Dead Poet Society, Green Card, Truman Show.
It's a weird movie, Mosquito Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't like it.
It doesn't have a happy ending.
Yeah. It's like you're just not sure what you're watching when you're watching that movie.
Yeah.
It is a little bizarre. But then let me get back to and then of course between Dead Poets and Fisher King is only a 2-year period, but then you have all these insane movies that we talked about. But even though I remember Awakenings, like I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Because again, these are like movies I was watching in college, and Awakenings was, you know, based on a true story. The Oliver Sacks book, and it was one of those films where you're just like, this isn't wacky Robin Williams.
Yeah.
No.
It's not Patch Adams.
No.
Yeah, it's wow. It's heartbreaking to see, him deal with Robert De Niro's character, who's, you know, catatonic to kind of waking up and then the one guy in the end. Spoiler alert. We probably should have said that at some point.
Yeah, we're going to spoil some of these. Yeah.
Yeah. For him to be the one who ends up back in that state too is heartbreaking.
And it's an amazing performance by Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
To play all those states of catatonic and various forms between catatonic and completely lucid and back again.
Yeah.
Was pretty fascinating. And it was one of those movies I remember watching it just going, Jesus. And I think like kind of going back to why this Robin Williams' death has affected me and so many of us so much is because he was able to personally connect on so many different movies and so many different roles.
Yes.
Like you said, and he also did fucking Patch Adams, which is
yeah.
Why was that movie made? You know what I mean? Like,
you brought up a really good point, and I think one of the reasons too we resonate so much with Robin Williams is nowadays there's a stigma if actors kind of go from adult movies to comedies to kids movies. And first of all, there's very few actors that can do it at all. But you know, when you look at like
just
The Rock
Diesel.
And or like
Vin Diesel. He's the only one.
Yeah. And you look at, and you're like, and they do it poorly.
Yeah.
But when you look at someone like Robin Williams, he can do everything from Aladdin to Jumanji to The Fisher King to Dead Poets Society. And you never feel once like, oh, he's just doing this for a paycheck, or he's phoning it in. And it's something that you can, and even Popeye too. Like, you know, he didn't, not a good movie, but did he phone it in?
No,
not at all.
He was Popeye.
Yeah. So
yeah, he's 100%.
You look at an actor in a career like that, you realize that, oh, we kind of grew up with him too,
right?
Because, and then we introduced our kids to him because of Aladdin and all the, and Jumanji. And this is, you know, our first introduction for our children to Robin Williams. And then when they're older, we'll show them the
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. Yeah. Like why it's affecting mainly people in our age group is we did grow up with him.
Yes.
You know, like we did watch him as a kid on whatever whether you're in your 30s or 40s, you watch him as a kid in something.
Yeah.
Right.
And you did then, oh, that's his voice in this animated thing. And then
right.
As you got older, you watched him do these very intense things like Awakenings and
right.
and had this heavy subject matter like The Fisher King. And you go, they're kind of stunning, like that he was able to do that, because then he has been a part of your life.
Yes.
On numerous ways.
I felt that way when I was in college, like when I was in my 20s, when Jim Henson died.
Yeah.
And I felt that was like a very personally affecting death of someone I had never met, but had affected my life.
And now, me too. I mean, I was only 8 when it happened. But you know, you grow up with the Muppets. And,
right.
The only 8 years that you had been alive had been with him. He had
right.
grossly Muppets, impacted your
Sesame
life.
Sesame Street, and then
exactly.
I'm right in the age range for Ninja Turtles. And,
mm-hmm. Every part of it. Boom. And then when you look at that with Robin Williams now, when we're older, you realize, oh no, when I was that age, I was also watching Robin Williams, and I never stopped watching him up until his death, really. In fact, we'll probably keep watching him because there's still movies he's been in that haven't been released yet.
Oh, yeah.
So I know there's at least another Night at the Museum movie, and then I think there's a couple more, too.
Yeah. And there's still a few scattered in there, you know, in the mid-90s, some independents that we didn't, you know.
Oh, sure.
Probably didn't check out. And
then you've got, like we said, Aladdin and Toys. But even again, like, I loved Toys when it came out. I'm sure
if I
watched it now, I would be like, what?
Oh, we all hated it as when it came out. We thought it was awful.
I just was so mesmerized by all
great
of
colors.
It. Yeah. Robin Wright and then LL Cool J and I don't know.
Disguised as the Pillows, that was pretty funny.
When he would come out of the wall or whatever, like that scene stuck out to me. And then Mrs. Doubtfire, which I did a Benson interruption of it a couple months back. Man, that movie has a lot of really ridiculous shit in there that makes zero sense. But going to Robin's acting, it is amazing what he does.
Yeah.
He is this old Irish woman. You know, obviously there's a lot of makeup and prosthetics, but that was what was so spectacular about it.
It's like Mike Myers playing Shrek.
Right.
It's like he literally, it's this character.
It would be like, though, if Mike Myers was a live-action Shrek.
Yeah. Right, right.
You know, and
which there's a live action Shrek on Netflix. It's the stage musical. Don't do it. But yeah, if Mike Myers had done it, it'd be great. But yeah.
Because again, and then what else did he do? Then he did Being Human, 9 months.
9 months is his role as the obstetrician in that one. I mean, it's amazing. It's weird, and he's Russian again. And
I don't remember that movie.
Yeah.
Was he in it a lot?
Yeah. Well, any time the pregnant lady, Julianne Moore, goes to the doctor. So yeah, It's quite a bit. And the delivery scene is hilarious. My family and I would watch that movie all the time just because that delivery scene is so hilarious. They're driving on the streets of San Francisco. They like hit a bicyclist and they get in the car. We're going to the hospital anyway. They stop short of an old couple and he starts having a heart attack. Get in the car. They drop them all off at once. You know, yeah. And then him in there as the doctor is so hilarious.
So let's go back here.
He takes a hold of that movie the way that, like, we all thought Quicksilver did in the last X-Men. You know, it's like that scene is amazing, mm-hmm. and yet it's only this one little piece of it.
Well, that's kind of his thing. If you look at his IMDb page, there are all these little parts that he has in a lot of bigger films. But he would do that though. You know, mm-hmm. he had that ability of, even if he was just in it. A small scene, it was a scene that you remembered. Oh, that was a Robin Williams scene.
Yeah.
And then Jumanji, which again is one of these really sort of inventive films. I mean, it's crazy, mm-hmm. and there's some cliche stuff in there that isn't great, kind of like Hook or whatever. But I don't know, a lot of people love Hook.
Yeah, that was another one growing up.
I will say, my kids loved Hook, but yeah. I remember seeing it as a kid. I didn't like it either. And it was the first time we'd ever saw in a review the word overproduced in a review. Yeah, when it came out, yeah, it was like big, giant, lavish sets and costumes, and then a story that was just like, you know. And but when you look back at...
you loved Hook though, right, Aaron?
I think as any one of my generation, yes.
You know, who also...
Everyone from that generation, when Doug and I would make fun of that movie on Douglas Movies, would get mad.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
In late 20s, early 30s, they always like, no, Hook's great!
Wow.
Like
yeah. I mean, we probably haven't seen it since we were nine. Now,
I will say, you know what really holds up is Dustin Hoffman's performance.
Yeah,
it's
hysterical. Hook, yeah.
Still.
Yeah, and Hoskins is... It's me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's funny you bring up Dustin Hoffman because he's like one of the only handful of other people who... Whatever character he's playing, you can't picture him in anything else.
Right.
That's what Robin Williams did, mm-hmm. you know, like, and you go through Dustin Hoffman's career. I mean, obviously it's more dramatic. That's who he is, but he has those parts where you're like, I can't picture him as anybody other than Ratso Rizzo. Yeah. I just can't. Yeah. I just can't picture him anyway. And then you can't picture him as anybody other than the guy in Rain Man.
Yeah.
You know? So why did Hook, why did you and your generation like Hook so much, do you think, Aaron?
I think, I mean, it was obviously bright and colorful, which all kids love, and there's sword fighting. Mm-hmm. And we all know the story of Peter Pan, mm-hmm. because we'd all probably watched the animated version of
yes.
it at mm-hmm. that point. So I think to take it to the next step of what else would happen, and I mean, you can look at that cast too. They're all really good. Mm-hmm. Besides Hoffman, Hoskins, and I think it's Gwyneth Paltrow's first movie.
Mm-hmm. Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts mm-hmm. is Tinkerbell. I mean, it's loaded. And then I don't know if we have, I mean, I know Jim Carrey's kind of been on a similar career track, at least trying to do drama and comedy. But has any actor acted with children as well as Robin Williams?
No.
And acted as a child, essentially, as in an adult body with children. I mean, Hook, you've got Jack, which isn't great, but it's still, mm-hmm. Who else could you see in that role?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I've talked to a development executive who worked in children's programming, and he said to me, children, they don't like watching other children. Like when you have shows about other children and stuff, what they like is to watch adults act like children. So you can see how broad Robin Williams's appeal was. Mm-hmm. And I really think there's some truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
As I look back on like the successful family and shows and movies and stuff, I'm like, were they always about kids? I'm like, no, they were, you know, about adults kind of acting childish, or the
right.
ones that mm-hmm. tended to resonate a lot.
Or
yeah,
whatever.
Or silly. Yeah, yeah. Like the roles like you're talking about.
Well, I want to talk about too Good Will Hunting, which came out in 1997, because that, again, like,
that movie came out of nowhere, too.
It came out of nowhere, and he's not really funny in it at all. He's funny. He's not being Robin Williams funny. He's being a good actor who's playing. Mm-hmm. This is how an Irish guy that grew up in Boston, who's a college professor, would be.
And who has a fair amount of mileage on him.
Yeah.
Like, there's certain... The thing I loved about it is that he has a worn, weathered look and mannerism about him that is not easy to do mm-hmm. for an actor, and you could tell he was tapping into some real sadness.
Well,
on
he's
his,
not.
At home.
He's also not a pretty boy,
right? Mm-hmm.
You know, and so he looks like a guy. He looks exactly like a guy that would be in that spot.
Yeah, mm-hmm. uh huh.
And
with it, you know, with some shit that happened to him in the past.
I mean, and the way they subtly handled some of the stuff, like he was in Vietnam. You know, there's a scene, Matt Damon just goes, you still counsel vets, you know, or whatever. And then his wife dies of cancer. And I mean, this movie was like, it came out of nowhere. Somebody, first of all, nobody knew who Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were.
Yeah.
And you're like, who the fuck is this kid? And then Robin Williams is playing this very quiet. I mean, it's a very intimate film because it largely takes place in a therapist's office.
Yeah. Yeah. And you it's know, a small cast, too.
It's a small cast. Minnie Driver, we'd never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And even Skarsgård, Stellan Skarsgård, had we seen him in much prior to that?
Not in the U.S.
No. Not in the U.S. And he shows up as and plays perfectly this pompous math genius. And all these guys, I mean, really never heard of Ben Affleck. We hadn't heard of Cole Hauser or Casey Affleck. Mm-hmm. And they're all like...
Oh, Ben Affleck was slowly emerging.
Yeah. Sure.
I knew him from Voyage of the Mimi.
Kids and wasn't this also
educational program?
Wasn't this also from Clerks 2, after Clerks 2?
It sure. No. Clerks 2 is like 2006
yeah.
or 2004. Oh, okay. It would have been right before Dogma, which they were both in together.
Right.
Which I think is part of it. I think Kevin Smith was a EP on...
what about Chasing Amy?
He had done Chasing
okay,
Amy.
Yeah, yeah,
he had
yeah.
done
yeah.
Mallrats.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
You know, he'd done...
He'd done Phantoms.
Oh, no, I was thinking of Mallrats. That's right.
Yeah, Phantoms came out after Good Will Hunting.
Oh, was it?
But again, Good Will Hunting was this movie that launched all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those, like... It's so great. I mean, it's... You know, Matt Damon, what he's dealing with. And I mean, first that montage of therapists that he has to go to for the court order, which was great. Bill Plimpton was like awesome, mm-hmm. you know. And then when the conversations too, like I love the arguments between Stellan Skarsgård and Robin Williams when they're arguing what to do with them, because they both are coming from the right. They're both coming from a genuine place. Like mm-hmm. one guy isn't obviously the bad guy.
Yeah,
he's just like, no, you got to work hard. And then Robin Williams is like, no, if you push him too hard. And the arguments that they have, the way they were. Sometimes in movies, they'll have these arguments where one person talks and then the other person talks, and mm-hmm. it's like. Not a lot of arguments go that way. Usually people are talking over each other and he did that very
only
well.
Only on the screen.
And then the relationship with Minnie Driver and then those scenes, I mean, like so many of those, that scene with Ben Affleck where they're doing construction and he's like, and Matt Damon's like, yeah, you know, grow my kids up here. And Ben Affleck goes, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, you got a gift.
You got a winning lottery ticket. Yeah. He goes, if you're still here, I'm going to kill you myself. He goes, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm going to be 50. And that's fine. You know, and it's just like, I remember having a conversation but with my buddy in high school and I was whatever. And he just said, you got to go, man.
Yeah, you got to host strip poker.
You got to do game shows and sell t-shirts out of a gargoyle garage. Yeah. Like you have to do this.
You've got a future.
You got to tell jokes in shitty bars because that's your only way of making money because you have no marketable skills. Like, you have to go out and do this.
You're actually terrible at construction. Yeah.
You have to have a movie ruined in Bulgaria.
You have to do a half a dozen pilots that never get picked up. But yeah, like that whole scene, and that, you know, there's heavy abuse stuff in there and all that. And I remember watching it. I've seen that
movie. Did Stanley Kubrick smack somebody in this movie?
Yeah. Just showed up on set.
Yeah.
Said, "I'm like your foster dad." Yeah. And it was like, one of those things where you just couldn't believe that it's one of those movies that when you're flipping through the channels and it's on, you stop.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you watch it.
Did it send you guys through down a Gus Van Sant, like chasing the dragon to try and find a good movie that he's done since then? Like,
no, I feel like it's been, I really didn't rough. Want that challenge.
Yeah. I tried.
I mean, it was like Drugstore Cowboy. And
did he do the Psycho remake too?
He did the Psycho remake. And then
I thought Elephant was going to be great. And no,
it's one of those things where you're just like, come on, Gus, come on, get it.
How do you make a movie about a school shooting not interesting to watch?
Right.
Ow.
He's one of those. I don't know if he was a guy like lost his touch or what, but so we'll skip forward a little bit.
I watched What Dreams May Come last night.
Really?
Oh, wow.
That, I was worried because I knew that was going to be heart-wrenching because that's all about a guy dying.
Yeah, it sure is.
Suicide. And I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was a kick in the chest. And, you know, I was counting how many times I broke down and cried, and it was 4, mm-hmm. which is a lot. It broke Up's record. I mean, it's amazing. And obviously, visually, it is.
Visually, especially at the time, it was like groundbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. I was saying to my girlfriend, I think they could do this easier now, but pull it off.
I never saw it. Because the subject matter at the time was like a little hard.
Yeah, it's definitely hard. Wait a year, maybe.
Yeah,
it's rough with him.
It's not when I remember watching it, being absolutely blown away by the visuals. Like, these were amazing. Like, I think it was also the time I remember seeing, like, this is when the to get into the video game aspect of it, like the CD-ROM adventures were really becoming popular, and that type of detail in a world that was being created, and that's. I think that tapped into a little bit when I was watching that movie, because these fantastic, colorful worlds were being created. I can't imagine watching that movie now. That makes a good point, Aaron. I think I might wait before I watch that one again because of the subject matters. But, you know, well, then we haven't even talked about World's Greatest Dad yet, which is, but where are we now on the list?
Well, we are coming, let's see, that was late 90s, so we're coming up, Dreams May Come, then you had Patch Adams, which we talked about,
right.
Then you had Jacob the Liar, then you had Bicentennial Man, 1999.
Yeah. Oh, we
Chris Columbus.
We skipped Father's Day, and that's okay.
Yeah, there's Father's Day.
Billy Crystal.
I remember that one.
Flubber.
Not good.
Deconstructing Harry.
His one Woody Allen film.
Yeah. Then we get into 2000s. And then we all of a sudden, again, he does this insane 1 hour photo, Death to Smoochie and Insomnia.
Yeah. Right.
And 1 hour photo and Insomnia I really like both of them.
Yeah.
Did really you really? Tense.
I did.
See, I thought 1 hour photo was awful. I really didn't like 1 hour photo. Now Insomnia,
it's a hard ride.
Like,
I mean, it's
it didn't
tension.
Resonate with me. It was I thought even Robin Williams, I thought he did the best he could for what the material was giving him. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a very contrived kind of character and story that they were trying to do. Like, look, here's like, you know, here's the psychopath as he's slowly deteriorating and you know, harassing this family, and like I never really bought it. But you know, Insomnia is another story. I thought
it is a music video director.
And it didn't resonate with me. Insomnia, I thought was much better.
Yeah. And I saw someone write about Insomnia.
Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Our hero.
It was right after I think it was his
Memento.
Movie after Memento. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
pre Dark Knight.
Someone wrote on Facebook, like, Robin Williams stood head toe to toe with Pacino and De Niro better than they stood head to head against each other.
Oh, yeah.
In Heat or later on, a terrible movie, won't even mention.
Yeah. If you look at who he's acted across, and who's directed him. Like, there's no other comedian that's done that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a handful of actors. I mean, there's really like it's maybe 10 names or something like that you could come up with if you start putting these people against. And I think because he would then do something like Death to Smoochie, maybe.
Now, Death to Smoochie, I liked.
Yeah, it's
really,
it's a wacky. Yeah.
It was one of those movies
it's a Danny DeVito film. Like, it's weird.
It was one of those movies that I really was expecting to not like. Yeah. And I thought, well, this is, you know, got terrible reviews. Yeah, it didn't do well. And I found it to have this weird kind of quirky charm to it, mm-hmm. especially with Ed Norton acting like, you know, this forgiving everyman.
Yeah. And you've had to watch a lot of children's programming.
Yes, so. And I've had to watch a lot of children's programming. So,
so to see the behind the scenes of that, John Stewart's in it. Yeah. Can I talk about the time I met Robin Williams?
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. that was around that time. I would have brought you a sample of his arm hair, but at the time he didn't have any because he'd done 1 hour photo and shaved it all off. I don't know if you noticed that, but. But yeah,
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, but it was 2002, and he was going back to stand up for, I mean, possibly 20 years, the first time in 20 mm-hmm. years, do his live on Broadway. And I was just a lowly concert security guard in San Diego in college, just, you know, doing a part time job. And, you know, one day I called in for work, and they're like, hey, you want to do this gig? You're going to guard Robin Williams' dressing room. And I was like, yeah, let me, yeah, get me in on that. Yeah, sure. Okay. Where, what, how? Okay. So I get down there and I'm, you know, kind of hanging out by myself. I meet his tour manager and then his wife. And then at the time, his wife, then he comes up and we kind of cordially say hello, but my hands are so sweaty. Cause I'm like, this is Robin Williams. I already know who he is at this point. He's already an Oscar winner. He's already a hero. Like like I said in my email to you guys, pitching myself to be on this episode, and I pitched hard.
It worked.
Well, yeah, you convinced us.
Exactly. You know, I'd seen his stand-up special at the Roxy just a million times, so this guy was a legend to me in only 2002. And just to meet him and to see him interact with the crew of the, you know, the stage crew, the lighting guys, the sound guys. I mean, he put on his own show for them, which was amazing, you know, because he could have just gone back and hid in his dressing room and been that guy, and nobody would fault him for it. He's, you know, he's got to prepare for a show, do his thing, but he lit them up, and then later on he came back out real quiet, and that's what I tell people when I tell them about meeting him is when I met him, I saw both ends of the spectrum. I saw the high, and I saw the quiet. And it's interesting that how quiet he could be. And he just kind of slunked around the room and looked at things on the wall. Cause this is a big performing arts venue in San Diego. So he's looking at all the cast photos and then he kind of sits down on the stairs above them and looks to me and just says, hey, so is this your main gig? And me knowing I was going to have this job had prepared, like, I'm going to be.
Did you pull out notes?
I should have. I really should have. Well, if I was less socially awkward, it would have gone much better. Because I was prepared. I was like, I'm a film major at San Diego State. Like, what do you got for me? You know, I didn't have any idea whether that would be offensive or whatever to him. I thought he might hiss at me or something and make a crucifix with his hands. That's what I expected. And then he says that sentence in that way, and I was just like, completely baffled by it. And I was just like, I mean, I work at the convention center too. And then we work at concerts and I think I used the phrase, that's my bread and butter. which I don't know how old I was at 19, but
that's your bread and butter at 19.
That was my bread. Yeah.
Wearing a security shirt.
And yeah.
Did you tell him he should get on the trolley?
A yellow
get off my lawn.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, we were in suit and tie, sir. Oh, I mean, this is
excuse me.
This is big shit.
Excuse me.
Yeah, and he just kind of went like, I mean, it was clear I missed my cue, Mr. DeMille.
So you were back to one.
Yeah, back to one. I mean, the one thing that was cool is that he came down and he looked at this photo of Hello Dolly, and the production that had been there, and you know, he gave me a Carol Channing impression, which I felt pretty proud of.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. So that was nice. But yeah, then he did a show. Actually, interestingly enough, I almost forgot the one moment we really shared that was super, super funny. And I tried to be professional the whole night, and that's why I was an idiot. The sound guy is going to mic him up. He's going to put a lavalier on him. He's got to strap it to his chest, 'cause Robin sweats like a, you know, like a gorilla.
Yeah.
I don't know the analogy.
Something that sweats.
A gorilla whore in church.
Yeah.
So the guy's strapping this thing to his chest, and he's like, Robin, can you pull your shirt up? So he pulls his shirt up with two fingers. Just imagine your hands to your sides and your elbows tucked in. He pulls it up like this and just looks at me like a kid whose mom has, you know, got a Kleenex, spit on it and dabbing off his face. And he looks at me, and I just fell down laughing. It was so ridiculous because he's, you know, this legend, and he just has this little kid face on him. I mean, maybe that's what was so relatable about him, is you know, that face he could always make.
You know. Well, cool, man. There's one of the Man of the Year, of course, came out in 2006, which is another like a comedian becomes president, which was again great social commentary. Lewis Black is in it,
right?
And you know, very, very fitting. So, you know, guys, if any of you haven't heard any of these movies we talked about today, go watch them. Go check them out.
And I do want to mention World's Greatest Dad. You guys have to see this movie. Yeah. It's probably one of my favorite Robin Williams movies. It's going to be unbelievably difficult to watch again because his son commits suicide in the movie. Oh,
his son is a complete dickwad.
Yeah. Yeah, and he kills himself.
But he kills himself.
So it's a really difficult movie to watch, but it's one of those movies that shows how funny and how poignant and sad Robin Williams could be all in the same film.
Yeah, and that quote that's been going around Facebook, you know, about how it's better to be alone than to be in a group of people who make you feel alone, that's from that movie. It's I assume Bobcat wrote that, though.
Probably.
I don't know why it's being attributed to Robin, but
yeah, I was at a birthday party for Murray Valeriano, who's been on this podcast.
Yay.
And was talking to
Road Stories.
Yeah,
I also used to intern for Road Stories.
Oh, right on.
Yep.
And Road Stories we just added to LA Podfest this year. And I was talking to a buddy of mine, and him and his girlfriend. We were talking about it, and she has a chronic illness, and she goes, "He had." Depression, drug addiction, and then found out he had Parkinson's. She goes, and I'm not saying this is any sort of answer or insight, but it made sense to me. She goes, she has a chronic like bone thing that's very painful. And she goes, if I found out I had to then deal with cancer or something else, she goes, I wouldn't want to keep going.
Yeah, and he also had a heart condition too. He had a valve replaced at some point. So.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know. I understand.
So check out these movies, and also just on a note, we were talking about it before. You know, if you are depressed and you're feeling really horrible, you know, call somebody, get help. Yeah. It's available, it's out there. And the good news, if I can give you any, is that mental illness is becoming more and more understood. Because this country, we're starting from ground zero with mental, literally with mental illness. We just don't know enough about it, and we're not educated enough about it. So call somebody, talk to somebody, help is available. Mm-hmm. And I know you said somebody had reached out to you after this happened too, Graham, which is great. I mean, I think we're going in the right direction with raising awareness with mental illness.
Yeah. Cause it's this whole, yeah, the whole,
there's less stigma.
Everything. Why would he?
It's starting to go away, which is good.
Good. Cause it's like he had everything. Why would he get cancer?
Right.
You know, if you start looking at like an ailment, an illness, not a choice.
Yeah.
You know?
And is it before, you're rich. Why did you get the flu?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are certain comedians or people in the media who are pointing at the medications too. And I think that's irresponsible. Like,
we don't know.
Yeah. We don't know. And those same medications are helping how many people?
We don't know. Yeah. They're helping people and whatever. They were misprescribed. You don't know that.
Yeah.
We don't know that. It's, I think, Chris, you make the point of like, we're just really starting to even be ready to try to understand this.
Yeah.
And I think we just need to all approach it like that. Like, let's just get as much information as we can because we don't have enough. We really, we you know, we don't have enough information. The medical community and science is trying to figure stuff out, and who knows. So yeah, if you're going through a tough thing, reach out to somebody, call a professional, you know, just Google help for that, you know, it might be support groups in your area, or even just call, like, again, call a friend. A friend called me and we talked, and it was, I'm glad she called me. Glad I was able to do something about it. So thank you guys so much.
This was a great episode. We really enjoyed doing it, and we hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. So we want to thank our guest, Aaron. Let's see if we can get it right. Brungart.
No heart.
No heart.
No heart in Brungart.
Brungart.
It's Brungart. The Germans have no heart. Hearts are for the weak. So, Aaron, where can people find you on the internets?
You can find me on Twitter at Hilarinous. That's HILAARONOUS.
Of course. Hilarinous. Yes. Sure. A German way for it to say hilarious.
Confusing way.
If you guys listen to any of the other All Things Comedy shows, Aaron has helped. Well, you work on the show, you've helped out over there with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're going to be at LA Podfest.
Of course.
So,
unfortunately, I have a wedding to go to on the Saturday, so I will be there Friday and Sunday.
Whose wedding?
A friend in Arizona.
Oh, come on.
I know.
Just Skype it.
Terrible. In. Terrible timing.
Terrible timing. Tell them to postpone it.
Podfest wedding?
Oh, we'll perform the ceremony. Come meet Aaron live at LA Podfest, September 26th through the 28th. Get your tickets at lapodfest.com. Thank you once again, Aaron.
Thank you.
My name, let's see.
Dream come true?
Right on, dude.
Glad we could make one dream come true.
We're able to do one once a year.
This was my make-a-wish.
And he's not even dying.
I'm not. I mean, we all are.
Well, invariably. So I'll be headlining the Improv in Hollywood, California, September 13th. And
That'll be a fun show.
Chris is going to be on it, and we're going to add some other folks, so stay tuned to that. Use coupon code Graham if you go to the improv.com website. Use coupon code Graham, get 2 tickets for $10. And then I will be headlining the Zanies in Rosemont, Illinois, right out there at that financial bank thing with all the restaurants and whatnot, September 17th through 20. And I believe if you wear a Palm Strike shirt on Wednesday or Thursday,
you will be arrested.
You will be handcuffed and maced in the face for dressing like an asshole. So be ready. You get discount tickets and also coupon code Elwood, I believe, gets you $5 tickets on any of the off. Obviously, Saturday, you got to pay full boat. But if you come on the off nights, get some discounts. And
Stanley Kubrick will slap you.
He'll slap you right in your yappy mouth.
Yeah, Elwood will be hard to remember in Chicago.
Yeah, Elwood. Yeah, they're not big on that word at all. There's not two guys still dressed up like that right now. All right, thank you once again, Aaron. Bungart.
Oh, thanks, Dad.
Let's see. Brungart.
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 No heart. I think we say it better.
Brungart.
Brungart.
Just Aaron.
It's like a fist.
Yeah.
Brungart. 1-2.
I would be remiss if I didn't mispronounce. I have to at least one name a show. So
that's true.
Congratulations, Aaron.
Have we done a bad accent?
Hello. I'm from San Diego. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's how they speak in San Diego.
That is.
Let's end this goddamn episode. Thank you, Aaron. My name's Graham Elwood.
I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first.